It is Thursday, February 16th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, U.S. President Donald Trump and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu seem to back away from the two-state solution. A third person is arrested in Malaysia in regard to the death of the half-brother of North Korea's leader.
North Korea has a long history of outsourcing assassinations to non-North Koreans.
And we learn how the daughter of slaves became one of the first African-American millionaires. It's all ahead. A day after U.S. President Donald Trump and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu projected a message of unity at a White House meeting, a Senate committee is holding a confirmation hearing for Trump's pick to be the United States' ambassador to Israel. The Senate Foreign Relations Committee is questioning lawyer David Friedman, who's a strong supporter of Israeli settlements and an advocate for moving the U.S. embassy in Israel to Jerusalem from Tel Aviv. A group of five former ambassadors who held the position under Republican and Democratic presidents sent a letter to the Judiciary Committee saying Friedman has extreme radical positions. Trump said Wednesday during a joint news conference with Netanyahu that the two-state solution may not be the only path to solving the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
So I'm looking at two-state and one-state. And I like the one that both parties like. I'm very happy with the one that both parties like. I can live with either one. I thought for a while the two-state looked like it may be the easier of the two. But honestly, if Bibi and if the Palestinians, if Israel and the Palestinians are happy, I'm happy with the one they like the best.
That prompted an immediate reaction from Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas, who repeated his backing of the two-state solution, meaning an end to the Israeli occupation of the West Bank and a Palestinian state with East Jerusalem as its capital. Palestine Liberation Organization senior member Hanan Ashrawi warned abandoning the two-state solution would destroy the chance for peace and undermine American standing abroad. Randolph-Macon College history professor Michael Fischbach tells International Edition's Victor Beatty it's hard to imagine any other viable path to peace than the two-state solution, which has been official U.S. policy for 15 years.
There's a global consensus that this is the only way to go. There is a global consensus backed by countless U.N. resolutions that this is the way forward. Settlements are illegal. There should be a full withdrawal to the 1967 borders. The Palestinians, compared to where they were in 19, as far back as you want to go, have made huge concessions in terms of what's their bottom line, not a defeat of Israel, not return to 1948, to take 23% of Palestine, call it a state, and leave it at that. So the ingredients have been there. What's been lacking is, frankly, the pressure from the United States, which, starting with President Clinton and the Oslo process, has basically backed away from the idea that there is an international consensus about what ought to be, and has allowed the two parties, which are vastly unequal in terms of power, to simply say, well, here, you guys figure out what you want to do. I thought in some ways, personally, what was most amazing was not backing away from a two-state solution, but Trump actually using the term one-state solution, which sends chills up the spines of many Israelis. I don't think he meant it in the way they do.
Does his statement set back the peace process, or does it broaden it to include another possible option?
No, from my perspective, it does set back the peace process because, first of all, it calls into question the role of the United States as a reliable partner in this process. Then the fact that since the administration of George W. Bush, you have a bipartisan consensus in the White House that, yes, with the Israelis, with the Palestinians, we too, the United States, and the rest of the world community agree that the end goal is a two-state solution. For the United States to now say, well, we're not really committed to end goal of this or that. We'll leave it up to the parties. When certainly the Palestinians have been loud and clear what they want, which is a two-state solution, is in effect giving the Prime Minister of Israel carte blanche to change the end goal.
Michael Fishbach of Randolph-Macon College. He says Mr. Trump did not elaborate on what a one-state solution would look like, but suggested it could become neither a Jewish state nor a Palestinian one, but either a multi-ethnic democracy or Israel's annexation of the West Bank, thus depriving Palestinians of citizenship. Well, joining me here in the studio is social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. So, Andrew, what's going on?
Well, we have a bit of breaking news. After the withdrawal of the nomination of Andrew Pudster yesterday for the Secretary of Labor position in the Trump administration, several news organizations are reporting that President Trump is about to announce Alexander Acosta as his new nominee for the Secretary of Labor. And so we're already seeing that name beginning to trend on social media even ahead of that announcement, and we're starting to see people trying to figure out what they can from what little they know or have available about Alexander Acosta. So what we've seen so far on social media is that he's apparently the dean of the Florida International University School of Law, a former Bush administration Justice Department official. He was actually an assistant attorney general in the Bush administration, and that he's Hispanic. So he would be, I believe, the only member of the Trump cabinet, if confirmed, who is Hispanic. That was something a lot of people were debating and talking about on social media during these nominations, is the representation of minorities in the Trump administration in high-level positions. So this would fill that. We're also looking today at hashtag Day Without Immigrants. This is a big rally across the U.S. where immigrants are staying home from work to show how dependent the United States is on the immigrant population. So we're seeing that hashtag trending. A lot of people using social media to organize that, share photos and videos from the rallies that they're staging across the country today.
Yeah, I mean, there's some restaurants just around my neighborhood. I live here in the district that are going to be, that are closed today.
Absolutely. Celebrity chef Jose Andres, who has a lot of very big name restaurants here in Washington, D.C., is actually closing his restaurants today as part of this, and he's been tweeting about that throughout the day.
All right. Well, thanks very much, Andrew. That's social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. Here are some of the top news stories trending. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson says Russia needs, says the U.S. could cooperate with Russia. The Somali presidential palace is attacked as the country's new leader moves in. U.S. Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis rules out military collaboration with Russia, and Islamic State claims responsibility for a suicide bomb deaths at a shrine in Pakistan. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
An international team of astronomers have released what they describe as the largest ever collection of exoplanet search observations that used a detection technique called the radial velocity method. The technique, also known as Doppler spectroscopy or the wobble method, detects exoplanets by recording and examining variations in the color of light emitted by the planet's host star. This detection method takes into consideration that, along with the influence the gravity of the host star has on the exoplanet, the planet's gravity in turn influences the star. The observations listed in the compilation led to the astronomers finding more than 100 potential exoplanets. By offering the data to the public, the researchers say they are able to provide unique access to one of the best exoplanet searches that have been conducted. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, we commemorate Black History Month by learning about Madam C.J. Walker. Malaysian police said Thursday they've arrested a third person in connection with the apparent assassination of Kim Jong-nam, the half-brother of North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. Authorities said those arrested included a 25-year-old woman identified as Siti Asha, who held an Indonesian passport and was positively identified from airport security camera footage. Police also detained a man who provided information that led to her arrest. On Wednesday, police said they detained another woman at Kuala Lumpur International Airport in the Malaysian capital. A police statement identified her as Dun Thuy Huong with Vietnamese travel documents and said she was also positively identified from security cameras. I spoke with Sun Yun Lee, professor of Korean studies at the Fletcher School at Tufts University.
In the past, North Korea has engaged in various nefarious activities of this kind, putting out a hit on various North Korean defectors and South Korean officials, as well as private individuals. So the fact that Kim Jong-nam is the eldest son of the daddy, Kim Jong-il, I would say has always been a bit of a thorn in the eye of the North Korean leader, the young, untested leader. Not because Kim Jong-nam had any political base, power base inside North Korea. He's been marginalized for over 20 years. But just the very fact that he is the eldest son and Korea has a long history of practicing primogeniture. So one day, if Kim Jong-un is removed from power by China or by anyone else, it is within the realm of the possible that the eldest son may be eased in his place as a proxy. At the same time, I think the real reason that Kim Jong-nam was assassinated this week is that he has been critical of Kim Jong-un in the past, quite publicly. For example, in October 2010, in an interview with a Japanese TV station, Kim Jong-nam did something that he probably should not have, which was to cast doubt on Kim Jong-un's credentials as a leader to be, and also to come out and say that he is against, Kim Jong-nam is against his father's plan for a third generational hereditary succession, which is, of course, a contradiction in a communist country. Then there's the question of motive. Why did it happen and the timing of all this? I might be reading a bit too much into it, but I don't think it's a coincidence that this assassination took place on the eve of a major celebration in North Korea, the birthday of Kim Jong-il, which is February 16th. It is the second most important national holiday in the North Korean calendar, and this year marks the 75th anniversary of the birth of Kim Jong-il. In 1997, just 3 years after assuming power, that would be Kim Jong-il, in the aftermath of his father's death in 1994, on the eve of his birthday, Kim Jong-il's birthday, so February 15th, 1997, Kim Jong-il's nephew was assassinated, gunned down, and killed in South Korea. The nephew had defected to the South in the 80s. He had run out of money, and he did something that was quite risky, which was to write an expose on Kim Jong-il and his royal family, and for that, he was killed by North Korean agents. That was probably a tribute, a birthday gift, if you will, for Kim Jong-il back in 1997. And I think the fact that Kim Jong-nam was killed just 3 days before the 75th anniversary of Kim Jong-il's birth is not a coincidence.
Fascinating. I hadn't heard that theory before. But of course, by being in Malaysia, it seems like it was easier to get to him in that location because normally Kim Jong-nam lived in Macau.
That's right. And I think the North Koreans would be less prone to be doing something like this, being so bold as to assassinate Kim Jong-nam on Chinese territory. That would be a serious insult to China. Of course, it would be a violation of Chinese sovereignty, as this case is. This, if proven to be true, and I think we have no reason to doubt it, if this is a political assassination engineered by the North Korean state, this means it's international terrorism. So Malaysia has all the reasons to be annoyed, and I don't think the North Korean agents or their surrogates would have done something like this in China. North Korea has a long history of outsourcing assassinations to non-North Koreans. For example, in 1973, Park Chung-hee, President Park, the father, the late father of the current South Korean president who has been impeached, he escaped death when a lone assailant, an ethnic Korean resident in Japan, ran into a major theater where President Park was speaking on August 15th, which is commemorated each year in South Korea, Liberation Day, liberation from Japanese colonialism, the gunman shot at Park Chung-hee. He ducked behind the podium, and one of the stray bullets entered the head of the first lady, and she was killed. That was back in 1973, and the assailant had been sponsored by the North Korean state. So the news coming out of Malaysia today that apparently, rather than North Korean citizens, there were non-North Korean people from Indonesia, Vietnam, Malaysia implicated in this, does not change the equation that the North Korean state most likely stands behind this evil plot.
Sung-Yun Lee, professor of Korean studies at the Fletcher School at Tufts University. This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hi, this is Larry London, the host of VOA's Border Crossing. I feature music and interviews with your favorite artists from all around the world. And you can not only listen, but you can interact live with us here in Washington, D.C. Border Crossings comes to you Monday through Friday at 1500 UTC GMT on VOA.
And so these were the famous hair care products here.
And this was...
This is International Edition. February is Black History Month here in the United States. Today we examine the life of one of the first African-American millionaires. Madam C.J. Walker embodies the quintessential American success story as someone who fought seemingly insurmountable odds to become one of the 20th century's most successful self-made female entrepreneurs. The daughter of slaves, Walker built a cosmetics empire selling hair care and beauty products for African-American women. VOA's Chris Simpkins reports.
And so these were the famous hair care products here.
And this was the original product container from pre-World War I, so it's pretty rare to find these.
Alelia Bundles cherishes artifacts that tell stories about her great-great-grandmother, Madam C.J. Walker.
Yeah, you know, Madam Walker really represents the American dream in its best light. She is a person whose parents had been enslaved. She was the first free child born in her family in the 1860s. And by the time she died in 1919 at 51 years of age, she had become a millionaire.
Walker became one of the 20th century's most successful self-made women entrepreneurs. After experiencing hair loss, she experimented with various treatments, inventing, and eventually selling hair care products for African American women.
But what I love is that she put her own image on the packaging, because at the time there were other companies selling products to black women, but they would put this sort of, you know, someone who didn't look black, and because they were really kind of exploiting the insecurities that black women felt, you know, because of European standards of beauty.
She traveled the country building a cosmetics empire made up of women who sold and distributed her products.
So it wasn't just about hair care products, selling hair care products, styling hair. It became about economic independence. And so what I love seeing in her life is that this hair care products business became a means to an end that empowered other women, that allowed them to buy homes for their families, to educate their children.
For the last 40 years, Bundles has spent countless hours researching and writing about Walker's extraordinary life.
The women also wrote letters to her where one woman said, "You have made it possible for a black woman to make more money in a day than she could in a month working in somebody's kitchen." So this was really showing women who would have been sharecroppers and maids and laundresses how they could support their families and be their own bosses.
Bundle says Walker was passionate about activism, including empowering African-American women. In 1917, she even organized a trade convention, which was one of the first national meetings of businesswomen in the country.
In her keynote speech, she said, "I want you as Walker agents to show the world that you care not just about yourself, but about others." At the end of the convention, the women sent a telegram to President Woodrow Wilson urging him to support legislation to make lynching a federal crime. She wanted them to use their power and their influence and their money to make a difference.
Madam C.J. Walker, more than a pioneer of modern hair care products. Chris Simpkins, VOA News, Washington.
Thanks very much, Chris. A fascinating look back at history. Well, firefighters are battling flames on the outskirts of New Zealand's second largest city on Thursday after a wildfire burned down 11 homes and forced hundreds of people to evacuate. The fire has so far consumed more than 1,800 hectares in the Christchurch suburb of Port Hills. About 130 firefighters were battling the blaze from the ground while crews in 14 helicopters and three planes were battling it from the air. New Zealand's military has been deployed to provide water tankers and engineering equipment, as well as firefighters and other personnel. A helicopter pilot who was a decorated soldier died in a crash while fighting the blaze on Tuesday. A state of emergency has been declared in Christchurch. Officials said the region had been unusually dry for 3 years, and the grass in the hills had turned brown over the southern hemisphere this year. Well, that is our show for today. Please remember to visit our website at voanews.com. We have a whole range of stories you might be interested in. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an international public service announcement by the United States government.
Jamal Mohammed al-Badawi is a fugitive who was wanted in connection with the October 2000 attack on the USS Cole, a U.S. naval vessel moored at the time in the harbor of Aden, Republic of Yemen. A Yemeni native, al-Badawi is a small man, standing 5'5" tall with black hair and dark eyes, and weighs about 175 pounds. He is 48 years old and also known as Jamal Mushin al-Tali, Abu Abdal Rahman al-Adani, and Jamal Mohammed Ahmad. The attack on the USS Cole resulted in the deaths of 17 American sailors. For this and other actions, al-Badawi is charged with murder, conspiracy to use weapons of mass destruction, providing material support for terrorist groups, and other crimes. He was being held by Yemeni authorities in connection with the attack when he escaped in April 2003. He was recaptured the next year, but escaped again in February 2006. The Rewards for Justice program is offering a reward of up to $5 million for information leading to al-Badawi's arrest or prosecution. The U.S. guarantees that all reports will be investigated and the identity of all informants will be kept confidential. If appropriate, the U.S. is prepared to protect informants by relocating them. If you have information on this man, contact the Regional Security Office at the nearest U.S. embassy and the tip line at www.rewardsforjustice.net or email information to rfj@state.gov.
That was an international public service announcement by the United States government.